dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose understanding of many aspects of that war I've been increasingly impressed by, most especially through his articulate description of them and his clarity about the stakes, as expressed in his weekly columns at the terrific online resource he runs, the Washington Free Beacon, and also in his appearances on Fox and Sunday television programs and elsewhere. He's, of course, Matthew Continetti, very bright, relatively young man who has really made an outsized contribution, it seems to me, to the public policy debate, and particularly with his latest essay at the Free Beacon that talks about peace fever as a phenomenon that is suddenly arisen mightily from some of the usual suspects. And to explore all that, I'm very pleased to welcome back Matt Continetti. It's good to have you with us. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
So, peace fever, I suppose that's to be juxtaposed against war fever. There's a lot of talk at the moment that that's what's awash in the Trump administration, thanks to the fevered imaginations and operations of the National Security Advisor, John Bolton. What's actually going on here, Matt, as you see it?
Well, Frank, it's a fascinating thing, and I was drawn to write about this because for the last week, Washington has just been gripped by the sense that a war with Iran is imminent. And yet, when I look at the public statements and actions of the Trump administration, I see no indication or even support for an attack, a preemptive strike on the Iranian regime. And so as I looked into this more deeply, I found that what's really happening is the so-called Iran echo chamber, the same group of officials and journalists and activists who supported Barack Obama's disastrous Iran nuclear deal in 2015, are now parroting a line that began with the Iranians, that John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, is somehow manipulating President Trump into a war with Iran, even though there's no evidence for that. And what I just take this to mean is that the Iranians and their allies in the United States are very worried that within the next few months, because of the Trump policies, not only will the Iran deal collapse fully, we've already withdrawn, but remember, Iran and Europe are still technically within the deal. Not only will that deal collapse fully, but the Iranian regime itself, I think, is imperiled by some of the economic sanctions and pressure.
Maximum pressure. I couldn't agree more, and I think this is a sign of real desperation. But I wanted to give a little bit of background to this term that you've used, the echo chamber. And of course, it's not your term. It is one that Ben Rhodes, who was the deputy national security advisor to President Obama for the last part of his second term. And there was a fascinating and really horrifying interview that he gave to the New York Times in 2016. And would you just remind us of some of the things that he copped to in that interview? It was a kind of fawning, you know, paean to his mastery of the political scene. But tell us what this was about, this echo chamber.
Ben Rhodes put it very well, and it's actually a remarkable admission, as you say, when he told a reporter for the New York Times Magazine in 2016, and I quote, "We create an echo chamber." These are my words, basically to attack opponents of the Iran deal through leaks and tips and background briefings to the D.C. press. And Rhodes went on, I quote, "They were saying things," the echo chamber was, "that validated what we had given them to say. We had test drives to know who was going to be able to carry our message effectively and how to use outside groups like Plowshares, the Iran Project, and whomever else. So we know the tactics that worked. And then he said later in the interview something also remarkable and revealing about how the left and how the Obama administration and its former, thank goodness, officials use the press. Rhodes said, I quote, "The average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. That's a sea change. They literally know nothing," close quote, meaning that they can be manipulated. And we see that now. I mean, the echo chamber portrayed critics of the Iran deal who had reasonable criticisms as being in the pocket of basically Jewish billionaires and Israel lobbyists. Then the same people, remember, these are the same people who once Donald Trump won the election have spent 2 years portraying him in the media as a Russian asset since 1987. Now, Mueller, of course, showed that there's no proof of that. So now they've moved on and they have a new target. And that target is clearly John Bolton. And this campaign blaming him or trying to say that he is attempting to maneuver us into an unprovoked aggression against Iran is insane. And I would also say, though, Frank, based on my close reading of the news this past week, there is a battle going on within the Trump administration over Iran policy. And there are some officials who are leaking and, quote, giving quotes to the New York Times and Washington Post within the White House, I think, who are trying to damage Bolton's standing as well. So there's no question the knives are out for John Bolton, and it's completely unjustified.
Well, not only unjustified, but it would be the most counterproductive thing I can imagine for this presidency and for President Trump himself. And their focus of effort is clearly to try to persuade him that John Bolton is going to get him into a war, and John Bolton is really running the country, and Trump is just living in his world and that sort of thing. But to your point, Matt, I want to come back to Bolton and the implications of all this in a moment, in our second block, I think. But I did want to just ask you specifically, to your point about the long knives inside the administration, the New York Times had a big story the other day, as you know, in which they described a war plan that was being pursued by John Bolton and was in the process of being implemented, it seemed, and no fewer than six, all anonymous, of course, but six people who were privy to that plan, which is an amazingly large number given the nature of anything like this, were essentially leaking and confirming others' leaks to the New York Times. The echo chamber, it would seem, that media element of the echo chamber, especially at work, no?
Yes. I mean, I was fascinated by that story because when it came out, I believe on a Wednesday, it was clear that this number, the 120,000 troops deployed, was the uppermost contingency in response to an escalation that Iran would begin. It was not a plan for the immediate deployment, you know, prior, before any rationale. And so that was clearly meant to scare off people from the current policy of maximum pressure.
We'll be right back with more with the great Matt Continetti of the Washington Free Beacon, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're visiting with Matthew Continetti. He is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. It is really required reading, I think, for all of us. Great investigative reporting, among others from our friend Bill Gertz, who's a regular on this program, and Adam Credo, and so many others, as well as Matt's own important column we've been discussing in the first segment. One of those particularly important ones that appeared today, entitled Peace Fever. So, Matt, we've got calibrated now, I think, what the Iranian agenda is, and that is to try desperately to stave off the unraveling of what's left of their regime and this sweetheart deal that the Obama team conjured up for them. We've got the echo chamber that slavishly follows their line. People like John Kerry, we've mentioned Ben Rhodes, Wendy Sherman, Peter Bergen, and others. If the president were to accede to what I think it's fair to say are a bunch of never-Trumpers' insistence that he has to get rid of John Bolton, obviously that would be a body blow to the maximum pressure campaign for Iran. But John's intimately involved, of course, as the national security advisor must be, in a host of other areas of the world in which vital U.S. interests are on the line as well. And I might just ask you to sort of reflect on sort of that portfolio, whether it's North Korea or China or Venezuela or Russia, to name a few, and what the impact might be should the president go that road.
Well, I would say it's always been and always will be, for as long as he's in office, Donald Trump's policy. And I think Ambassador Bolton understands that. And he has said in public frequently that he has, of course, well-known views on a variety of issues. But when he became a member of the Trump administration as the National Security Advisor, it was his job to coordinate the president's foreign policy. If he were to leave the administration, I think it would be a blow in a couple of ways. One is Bolton, as even his critics acknowledge, is an expert bureaucratic operator and knows how to get things done. He's very competent. And competence is something that sometimes is missing from the implementation of Trump policy. So I think Bolton's departure would hurt in that sense. I also think Bolton, of course, as we all know, is beloved by American conservatives. And for him to leave early or in a, you know, unsettling way probably would dampen conservative enthusiasm for Trump foreign policy. I think especially as Trump engages, say, in personal diplomacy with Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin, a lot of American conservatives are heartened by the fact that Trump has people like Bolton and Mike Pompeo on his team who are there to provide, you know, more realistic, even, you know, hawkish assessment of the intentions and capabilities of hostile regimes. So I think it would hurt President Trump if John Bolton were to leave precipitously or under bad circumstances. But I would also say I don't think there's any reason to expect that. I think what we're witnessing is a whisper campaign against Ambassador Bolton. And as long as he's able to show that he is doing his best to pursue the foreign policy objectives that President Trump has outlined, I think he's in an okay position.
Yeah. Well, I certainly hope so. And most especially, I just can't see the president thinking that people who have been adamantly opposed to everything he stands for are the sort of people from whom he should now take advice. I did want to just also ask you about, Matt, one other aspect of this, and that is, how do you think it would be seen in, well, places like Beijing and Moscow and the capitals of North Korea and Venezuela, for example, were the president, to say nothing of Iran, were the president actually to take out his right-hand man in the foreign policy arena? And I want to second what you've said about his role as an implementer of the president's policy, not as as an independent, you know, actor here. But how would it be seen in terms of the Trump presidency, do you think?
Well, I think our adversaries would be very happy to see John Bolton leave the administration. Though I would also add that happiness is bound to be short-lived because I don't want to play into this narrative that somehow John Bolton is the driving force of Trump foreign policy. It has always been Trump, and it always will be Trump as long as he is president. And I think Trump, you know, he is willing to extend olive branches and try to reach some agreement. But we have seen him, to his credit, again and again, pull back. And when he realizes that the dictators and tyrants are not going to act in good faith, he does implement harsh measures, as he should. So there would be, I think, a celebration in a lot of these capitals if Bolton were to leave. But again, I think they would be disappointed by President Trump, and rightfully so.
Yeah. Well, I hate to risk emboldening any of these guys. Hey, Matt, let me quickly ask you about another issue that I know you're following closely, both personally and of course, at the Free Beacon. And that is the whole issue of this incredibly important turn of events, it seems to me, with Attorney General William Barr deciding that there's enough evidence of possible wrongdoing with respect to what was the run-up to, the pretext for, if you will, the investigation of candidate Trump and the so-called collusion allegations with Russia. Namely, the investigation of the investigators now being entrusted to this U.S. attorney in Connecticut, John Durham. What does this portend, and how do you think it's likely to play out?
Well, all I can say is it seems like a lot of people are frightened by this new investigation by the U.S. attorney into the origins of the Russia investigation. The news that Attorney General Barr had appointed the U.S. attorney came out. There was also a leaked story that Brennan and Clapper had opposed using the infamous Steele dossier as part of the FISA application for Carter Page, whereas Comey, according to the story, had supported it. And so what that showed to me was the men behind the Russia probe are turning on each other. that suggests to me that they're worried about what we might discover in the coming months. And so it's been a very interesting development. And again, I think speaks to just the credibility and effectiveness of Attorney General Barr. I mean, we were talking about Ambassador Bolton's being a very effective bureaucratic operator. The same must be said of Attorney General Barr, who has really established himself as one of the most capable Trump cabinet officials. Just an extremely impressive man.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And Matt, is it likely in your expectation that if these guys are turning on each other now, and I think you're right, they are, that we're going to see a lot more of this, and in the process, probably a lot more evidence of criminal wrongdoing, not just, sort of malfeasance?
Right. I mean, we'll have to see. I mean, I would just say, though, I mean, we have the Horowitz IG report that will be coming out. We have the Huber report that's been going on for years. And now we have this U.S. attorney investigation. So there are going to be multiple investigations, and all of them are going to reveal interesting information. And how it concludes, I don't think anyone really knows. And that's what's frightening, I think, the people who were behind the Russia investigation, people like, Brennan or Clapper or Comey or Strzok, right? I mean, this uncertainty is what's getting them nervous.
Yeah. Matt, to that point, as you look at this, we're, of course, having this conversation in the midst of extremely, shall we say, high intensity concerns being expressed on Capitol Hill, specifically in the Democratic circles on the House of Representatives, about a constitutional crisis over Bill Barr not providing, a handful of redacted, sentences out of the Mueller report. When you look at constitutional crises, and you're a pretty serious student of history, I think it's fair to say, doesn't what we're talking about here in terms of an apparent conspiracy on the part of senior Obama administration officials to prevent the candidacy of Donald Trump in the first instance and then to sabotage his presidency subsequently really constitute a constitutional crisis? And could there be some correlation between the allegations of the first as a pretext for detracting attention from the second?
Well, I do think there's a lot of distraction campaigns being waged, and we're just going to have to see the results of these investigations. I mean, certainly it would be an abuse of power if the worst fears are proven true about the origins of this investigation. Whether it rises to constitutional crisis, I don't know. I have a very high bar.
You're the last man in Washington who does.
I might think I'm the last man in Washington, right, as you say. But it would certainly be an abuse of power. And that type of abuse of power is what the Constitution is meant to limit. I mean, if anything, what these shenanigans prove to me is the necessity to limit the administrative state and the permanent structure of government in Washington, D.C. Jim Comey is not the emperor of the United States. And yet sometimes he lends the impression that that's exactly what he thinks he is. That's not the case. So I hope we can start to really take apart this bureaucracy and hold it accountable.
Amen. Well, you do a marvelous job contributing through the pages of the Washington Free Beacon to such accountability. And I thank you, Matt, not only for that work and those of your colleagues, but also for your visits with us from time to time. I hope you do it again soon. Next up, Mark Langfang joins us. We'll talk more about Iran, what the influence operators are up to, and the realities of the topography of the Middle East and what it might mean for the future of a peace plan from Jared Kushner, and more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is my distinct pleasure to say, joined by an old friend and much admired colleague. His name is Mark Langfang. In the spirit of Cincinnatus, Mark is one of those people who has sort of dropped from time to time the duties of his real estate practice and management affairs in places like New York City to attend to our nation's national security needs. He hasn't done it in government, but he's been extraordinarily impactful, influential, and clear-eyed in his efforts to educate both policymakers and the public about specifically challenges that we're facing with respect to the Middle East and our friend there of the greatest importance, the State of Israel. He does this in a unique way, and we're going to talk with him in the second segment, in our second segment with Mark, about a map, a three-dimensional map that he has developed to help work through what is the nature, the reality of the Middle East, and why it ought to bear a considerable impact on the policy choices that we and others make. But before we get to all of that, I do want to follow up with the conversation that we've just had with Matt Continetti about the very concerted effort being made now by clearly Iranian influence operators and their fellow travelers in the United States, many of whom served in senior positions in the Obama administration, to try to relieve the pressure on Iran and, well, give it a new lease on life, that odious regime that threatens death to America and death to Israel at every turn. Let me first welcome Mark Langfang back. So good to have you, Mark. Thank you for taking a few minutes to discuss these important issues with us today.
God bless you, Frank. You have been the rock of Gibraltar for not only the pro-Israel community, but the pro-United States community for as long as I can remember, which is at least 30 years.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to work with you in the course of those three decades. Mark, let's start with Iran. You have been very clear-eyed, as I say, for many years about the nature of the regime there and the threat that it poses to both our friends in the Middle East, Israel prominent among them, and to our own nation. And I just wondered, as you look at what's going on now with respect to John Bolton, who has been similarly, I think, very realistic about the nature of the Iranian threat. What do you make of this clear effort by Iran and its, well, as I say, fellow travelers, its surrogates, its proxies, its enablers to try to get President Trump to dismiss him as national security advisor?
I think it would be an absolute catastrophe. John Bolton has a vision of maximum pressure. And the unfortunate situation is Barack Obama left this country with numerous catastrophic existential threats on almost every axis there is. I mean, if you just look at North Korea and Iran, and that's the real key, in that you have to look at those two not as two separate problems, but two sides of the same coin, because they're partners with each other. So don't expect to make a deal with North Korea if you're going to at all go soft on Iran. In fact, I always joke, when North Korea looked at the deal that Obama gave Iran, they said to themselves, it's almost like the Rodney Dangerfield of nuclear arms, quote-unquote, agreements. And they said, I don't get no respect. Here, I've got some nukes, and you're giving all the goodies, you're giving $150 billion to Iran that doesn't even have any nukes yet, supposedly. So unless President Trump is firm and steady, and firm and steady with someone like Bolton, his whole foreign policy could very well collapse.
I'm so glad you made this point about the larger strategic context here. Were the president to fire John Bolton, which I think would be, as you say, a catastrophe, in the face of the kind of pressure that we're confronting now in virtually every quarter, and John is at the forefront of trying to contend with that pressure, whether it's from, you know, the Iranians or the North Koreans or the Venezuelans or China or Russia, all would be emboldened and would consider this to be a huge victory. And indeed, it would be. So I'm prayerful that the president is not going to have any truck with us at all.
I would go further. I would say if he fires Bolton, he becomes a lame duck, period, because the entire strategy here, as enunciated by, unfortunately, the former Secretary of State Kerry, when he violated the Logan Act, really violated the Logan Act, went to negotiate with Iran after he lost power, and during the Trump administration, which is really a violation of the Logan Act, instead of during a transition period where there is de facto as well as de jure rights of an incoming administration to negotiate with foreign powers. Here, it's a wait that he basically, Kerry went to Iran and said, listen, he's going to be a one-term president. Just ride him out. So that now, I believe, let's just ride him out, is the operative strategy of all of America's enemies, because they've been told by the Democrats, by Kerry or by whomever, including, by the way, if you want to talk collusion, look at what China is doing to the Farm Belt, where they know that this is specifically for electing Democrats. So we're in a situation here where if he does lose Bolton, everyone will see all these bad actors, malign actors, will realize that there's nothing in the next year and a half that President Trump is going to be able to push any dial on. And I'm talking from trade agreements to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, the entire spectrum. He will become a lame duck, period.
I feel that's right. Let me just take another couple of minutes with you, Mark, and then we'll have to pause. But I did want to just urge you to assess the threat that the Iranian regime represents in the region and now increasingly to us. You mentioned that they putatively do not have nuclear weapons. I want to see if you're among those who think they may well have gotten their hands on them, in particular because of that relationship they have with North Korea, which is considered the exporting of weapons of mass destruction to be one of their few cash crops. but also the nature of the regime itself, Mark, and why it poses such a mortal threat to, well, the Jewish state, for one, and the great Satan, as they call us.
Well, it's a very simple thing. If you look at Adolf Hitler and you say, Adolf, why don't you get smart? Okay, what would Adolf have done? He would have put on a hijab and said, listen, I'm not a secular Nazism. I'm a religious Nazism. I'm a religion. I'm declaring myself a religion, and I'm going to put a hijab on myself. Okay, what would have happened? Oh, it's freedom of religion. Freedom of, you can't attack Nazism. It's freedom of religion. Well, what is the modern day the Iranian Empire? It is Nazism with a hijab. That's it. And for some reason, we as a Western democratic power with a constitution, we're going to have to deal with having a provision that protects religions. But at the same time, the religion is not what we had provisionally known as a religion and confined to the church or the synagogue. But we're talking a political Muslim Brotherhood type of religion, which is seeking to become the law.
Yeah. Mark, I'd cast this a little bit differently, but I think it says the same basic thing. It's Sharia. And whether it's the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood stripe or it's the Shia Iranian regime type, it's about a totalitarian political ideology, which you're certainly right, has a sort of patina of religiosity to it. But fundamentally, this is about power, not about faith. And I think what we're dealing with here is a real threat from those who are seeking to impose it on the rest of us. And Mark, they're doing it, it seems, in a variety of asymmetric ways at the moment. Do you believe, as I do, that it was almost certainly Iranian saboteurs who attacked those four ships, and certainly the Houthi drones are being used against Saudi Arabia now from Iranian provenance, and this sort of thing happening throughout the world?
I would even take it another step. It might not even be drones. If you look at the latest intelligence, and I'm just writing an article on this, you have Iranian dhows, which are these wooden, sturdy sailboats that, you know, have been around for thousands of years in the Persian Gulf. And American intelligence saw missiles being loaded on these dhows. Now, what missiles would you put on a dhow? Well, you could very well put an anti-tank missile on a dhow. The problem is exactly the Iranian approach of asymmetric warfare.
Mark Verlengfan, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to visit with you about the particular problem that Israel is now facing, this so-called two-state solution, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are continuing our very important conversation with Mark Langfan, the map man, as some of us have called him over the years, because one of the things that he's introduced extraordinarily helpfully and effectively is the geographic realities of the Middle East, whether it's with respect to the high ground in the immediate vicinity of the state of Israel, or whether it is elsewhere in the Middle East, and how that bears on the security situation in which we ourselves, our friends and allies, notably but not exclusively Israel, find themselves. And Mark, I wanted you to just sort of set the stage for us, if you could. Let's focus in on Israel for the moment, because that's, we're told, the object of a new peace plan that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is poised to unveil at any moment. I just wanted you to sort of set the stage for us in terms of the lay of the land, literally, in that part of the world.
Well, the key to the Arab-Israeli conflict is the topography of Israel, in specific the mountains of the Golan Heights, and most importantly, the mountains of the West Bank, because the West Bank was in fact misnamed in that people think it's a salient bank of a river when in fact it is the sort of the, they're not really mountains, but they're very big hills of Judea and Samaria, where you realize they might be hills, but when you have a very narrow band from about 50 miles, hills that go up 1,000 meters actually could be more steep than mountains.
More steep or more strategically significant?
Exactly. In that the height, you know, the Golan Heights has been treated by the Trump administration as being somehow special because it's the heights. And of course, you intuitively understand it's, you know, the heights, the mountains are important strategically. You don't have to be a patent to understand that. But the problem is Jared Kushner's plan is, I believe, from all reports, a riff of an older Israeli plan called the Alon Plan. Now, the Alon Plan basically breaks up the West Bank into two geographic areas. One is the Jordan Valley, which is the area between the Jordan River and the watershed crest line of the West Bank, which is the eastern part of the West Bank, and the western part of the West Bank, which is the ridge line, the watershed line to the Green Line. And the reason this is because when Israel took over the West Bank originally, there were almost no Palestinians in this eastern part, and all the Palestinians were in the western part. But this is the key. Most people think, when they think somehow there's going to be territorial compromise, that you're in a tug of war with a rope. And when you cut the rope, you keep the part of the rope that's closest to you, and you give up the part that's closest and to the other person. But when you actually understand the Alon plan, or the Alon / Kushner plan, it's the exact opposite. The area that Kushner would be creating a Palestinian state is the part that's closest to Israel. And the part that Israel would be annexing is the part that's furthest to Israel. But the question is, how do you get from Israel to this part that's quote-unquote being annexed? It's going to be sandwiched between a hostile Palestinian state on one hand and Jordan, which probably will get overthrown in 3 minutes after the Palestinian state, on the other hand. So the geographically, I believe the Kushner plan isn't going to make any sense. But then there are four other deal breakers. He is not at all in his plan, from what I see, dealing with the airspace of the West Bank. Now, Israel's going to have to control the airspace, or there, this is a, in Israel, it's sort of a dirty secret that there's a consensus, because it's famous. If you have two Jews, you have three synagogues. You know, if you have two generals, you have five plans, except on this one issue of airspace, there's pretty much a consensus that you have to keep the airspace of Israel. So the plan doesn't deal with airspace. The plan does not deal with the electromagnetic spectrum, where you can't have two different electromagnetic spectrums in such a space, especially because the Palestinians can jam Israel's entire electromagnetic spectrum. Three, immigration into this area. Four, water. The topography is key to understanding the water issues, where from this Western Samaria issue area, which Jared Kushner would be ceding to the Palestinian state, into pre-67 Israel. Now, that water is not only important for fresh water, but more importantly, the Palestinians have refused to clean their refuse water when they go to the bathroom, and they flush all of this effluent into the aquifers, which then seeps into Israel's aquifers. I call it jihad by toilet. So taking all of these factors, the Kushner plan, if it indeed is a riff on the Alone plan, and from all indications it is, would be an absolute disaster.
Let me ask you, Mark, because I concur based on what we know to date, and we don't know a whole lot about the Kushner plan, but it sounds as though at the minimum it is going to create a separate part of the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, whatever you want to call it, for the Palestinians, and it is going to throw, by some accounts, $25 billion at the Palestinians to induce them to accept that part, which would then somehow be connected up with the other Palestinian-controlled areas in Gaza. I did want to ask you both how that connection would work, as you see it, and also something that you said that is really so central to this, that Israel would be confronted with a hostile Palestinian state. Now, the whole theory here is that there's going to be peace between the two parties, is it not? And if that's not the case, how on earth could Israel make these sorts of concessions?
It is beyond me. And what is really beyond me is the failure of Trump. I mean, I love President Trump, except there's one glaring problem. He made a statement, which is the core of the issue. He said that the pay to slay has got to stop, in that the Palestinian Authority pays Palestinians to murder Jews. They consider that a fundamental, that's their existence. Now, as long as you are paying people to murder Jews, and when they get into jail, you're paying their families and whatever, how could you have peace when you're paying people to murder Jews? That's your plank. And so he said this is encouraging terrorism. Well, yeah, duh, it is encouraging terrorism. So what has the PA done? They've gone absolutely full bore where they say that is never going to change. So it almost is an insult. What Kushner is doing is almost an insult to Trump. No, it is an insult to President Trump, in that here the Palestinians have rejected stopping their paying to slay under every penalty possible. And Kushner is going like as if they haven't rejected it.
Yeah. Well, this is, as has been called, I think it was Samuel Johnson who said of second marriages, the triumph of hope over experience. There's been a lot of hard experience, including that you're describing, Mark Langfen, in which these guys are paying, you know, Palestinians and their families for murders of Jews. This is not going to end well, I think. Mark, we've got so much more that we need to talk to you about, but we can't do it today. Unfortunately, we are hard out of time. I appreciate what you do, Mark. Thank you for your great work, specifically as the map man, bringing these realities to all of our attention. Look forward to continuing our great collaboration. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.